Okay, part number two of early American Jewish sporting pride, I guess you'd call it. Sports pride, Jewish pride in sports, I should say. Keep getting tongue twisted on that. But today, as opposed to last week, we're going to talk a little bit about some of, not too many, but some sort of influential events in American Jewish history that really sort of bring Judaism not just to the people in the villages, the people in sort of their little towns, wherever they lived, as we've been talking about, but rather into the mainstream, that the Jewish sort of pride that people played with when they were in sports, sort of brought it to sort of the greater American culture. And there are not too many of these. And we talked about this last week a little bit, which is that if one were to make it in a sporting sense, in American culture, oftentimes it came with a lack of religiosity, which was unfortunate, obviously, to us, at least. But in a sense, that's what you had to do in order to make it, being that it had sort of no sensitivities towards religiosity. You know, you had to play on Saturdays, you had to play on Friday nights, things like that, that just go hand in hand with actually making it as a successful athlete. And even the ones that we'll talk about today were not particularly religious, even though they did have a sense of Jewish pride. I'm going to pull out a handy-dandy, let me get this out here. We have a PowerPoint for today. So here we go. Give me a second here. This one, okay. Alrighty. People see just the PowerPoint or they see my whole screen? Hopefully just the PowerPoint.
See the whole screen. Now we see the PowerPoint.
Okay. So let me try to expand this a little bit. Here we go. Early American Jews in sports, too. As last week, this is in memory of Larry Schoen, Leibish Velvel Ben Yisrael Zisha. As we have Aaron here today, and as we said last week, one of the wonderful joys that Larry had was obviously his family, obviously Yiddishkeit, and then I don't know how it ranks, but somewhere after there, sports. Anyone who knows Larry knows how much he cared about sports, even if it meant going down with the local Detroit teams. He still cared. He still, supported them, had pride in them, and he certainly has pride in some of the history, which we'll talk about today. So, first of all, is early 20th century boxing. This is an interesting one because you don't really hear much about it nowadays because boxing has sort of fell to the, to the wayside. It's not really something people, there are a couple fights here and there that make big, a big PR push because, they try to revive the sport this way or that way. Nowadays, they have even more aggressive types of fighting, which are popular. What's it called? I don't even know what it's called. What's it called? UFC. I don't know what it stands for. Ultimate Fighting Challenge. I don't know. But either way, that's more than just punching. Boxing was just punching. And I found a very interesting, intriguing article about Jews entering boxing. We talked a little bit about it last week in terms of, what was his name? Mendoza. I forgot his first name. But famous boxer in England in the 18th century already. And we said that so when the immigrants came over to America, they also got involved in boxing, but it hadn't really professionalized in the same sense until, in the sense that it is now, until sort of the late 19th century, early 20th century. And when the Jews came to America, especially on the Lower East Side, so this was a popular avenue for them to take. Why was it so popular? So you see here, this is an article by Alan Bodner, When Boxing Was a Jewish Sport, myjewishlearning.com, which is good for some basics about Judaism, but he says, Jews entered the ranks of American boxing in large numbers, and by 1928, they were the dominant nationality in professional prize fighting. Unbelievable. The Jews were the main fighters, right? Nowadays, maybe you can't even tell what ethnicity is the main one, but back then, it was the Jewish sport. However, even though by 1928, they were the dominant nationality in boxing, when World War II ended and the GI Bill of Rights, which sort of gave extra not encouragement, but availability opportunities to people that came back from the war. So, and other avenues of advancement became available. Boxing was no longer attractive to the Jews as participants. By 1950, there were virtually no Jewish boxers, and their number had been minuscule ever since. Nowadays, you find very, very few Jewish boxers that at least make it onto the national scene. There are a couple, but very, very few. And even people don't care about them because boxing itself has fallen to the side. But back then, boxing was a big deal. They used to have boxing matches. Nowadays, you never find this. They used to have boxing matches in baseball stadiums so people could all attend. Now, they still have it in Madison Square Garden because that sort of, it presents itself as sort of a catch-all type of stadium. But it used to be that was the main event, was to go to boxing matches. But this success must be viewed in the context of overall Jewish participation in boxing. Throughout the 1920s and 1930s, approximately 16% of the champions were Jewish, but nearly one-third of the fighters were Jewish. While there were indeed Jewish champions, Jews did not excel out of proportion of their numbers and were in fact underrepresented at the championship level. In boxing, at least, Jews could be average, a possibility that was not available in other sports such as baseball. I love that twist at the end. Because what he's basically saying is, in truth, Jews weren't so spectacular. And even though they weren't spectacular, they still made a dent in the sport. They were still a noticeable, population, which can't be said about other sports. Because when it comes to Jews in other sports, the only way you can make it, the only way you can sort of make a splash is if you're exceptional. Back then, you could be sort of unexceptional and still take over the sport. Which is just, I thought that was a very intriguing way to look at it, because I looked at it as well. Not so special that the Jews were overcoming.
There you go, Jack Io. That's my uncle. He boxed from the 1920s to the 1930s, made his title like a career.
Where?
Oh my God. He started off in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
He retired in Chicago.
Nice.
He's got 20 articles about the guy.
Very
all
nice.
Boxing matches.
Cool.
It was a Jewish sport.
Yeah. In many ways, the Jews owned the sport. I mean, it's not like they had all the. They didn't have all the same kind of. They didn't have all of the. Oh, sorry, someone's trying to get in. They didn't own all of the sport, but they were a dominant force in the sport, even if they weren't so. Even if they weren't so prominent in it, in terms of their representation at the top, they were prominent in the fact that they were known to be the main nationality. Okay, why am I bringing this up? Last week we talked about there were a lot of Jews in sports. The question, however, is not as much, are there Jews in sports? For us today, we're looking at where do we find pride in sports? Where do we find that not only were there people that excelled at the sport that happened to be Jewish, but that they brought their Judaism with them in the sport? And that's really what we talk about today. And therefore, it wouldn't make sense just to talk about how they were dominant in the sport, but rather to see this. Now, I know what people are going to say. We're going to get to Max Baer in a second. But here you have Ruby Goldstein, you have Georgie Abrams, and you have Max Baer. What do you find in particular is noticeable? Obviously, the Jewish star on their boxing shorts, meaning it wasn't just that they played the sport, they happened to be Jewish, but they wore the Jewish star as sort of like a badge of honor, right? That would be their sort of a great denominator that they would all wear the Jewish star. Not all of them did. And some of these pictures were hard to find. There were more well-known boxers that were Jewish that I couldn't find pictures of. People named Benny Leonard and Barney Ross. I don't know if people know boxing. I certainly don't. But those were some of the main names back then that were champions of the sport. I'm not sure if any of these became champ. Max Baer was a champion, but I'm not sure Ruby Goldstein or Abrams ever made it to sort of like the top of their field. I think Ruby Goldstein was like a main contender. Benny Leonard was, Barney Ross was, but I couldn't find the Jewish stars. The reason I bring Max Baer in. So first of all, I talked to David about this yesterday, or a couple days ago, that David Barth, Max Baer was not Jewish. Definitely not according to our standards. His father wasn't even Jewish himself. His father was only half Jewish. I think his father's father was Jewish. So technically, Max Baer was what they would call one quarter Jewish, whatever that means. For us, there's no such thing as being partially Jewish. You're either Jewish or you're not Jewish. But the reason that Max Baer is important, especially because of what we're talking about today for Jewish pride, is mostly because of this fight that you see here. You can see the Jewish star on his boxers, his shorts that he played with while he was boxing, that looked like boxers. But he has a Jewish star. This, I think, is the first time I read that this is the first time he wore the Jewish star. Why did he wear this Jewish star? You can notice the date here, June 8th, 1933. He's playing against a guy also named Max, but his last name is Schmeling. As you could probably predict, he was German. And the reason this is important is because apparently, this is what I read in a couple different places, Max Schmeling had the support of Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo. They had correspondence and he was trying to support him. And when Baer took this fight against Schmeling, I think this was in New York State, the Yankee Stadium, there was a lot of controversy around it, you know, anti-Semitism and things like that. Given that Hitler had just risen to power, or at least he was prominent in Germany at the time, and there was a lot riding on this, sort of in terms of like the image of the Jew versus the German, it so happens to be, you can actually watch this fight. I don't know if people have really the stomach for watching boxing or the patience to watch boxing, to be more specific. I find it very boring. Usually it's just them sort of punching like every 15 seconds, and then they run away from each other, and then they hug each other, and then like you have to wait until, you know, some random time of the fight where they're actually going to start fighting. So this happens, I don't know, the seventh round or so. Max Baer wins by what they call a technical knockout. Not to get too specific into this sport because I don't know it too well, but also because people don't care. That technical knockout basically means that you've defeated your opponent so much physically. You've defeated them so much physically that the referee stops the fight, right? For the safety.
Also, if you knock them down three times in the same round, isn't that a TKO?
Is that? I don't know. I don't actually know. That could be. That would make sense, I guess. If you knock them down three times, that makes sense. That would be, you get points for that. I don't know. But either way, Max Baer, who's on the right, don't be confused by the way I set the names up. Max Baer knocks out Schmeling, and it was only a couple days later, by the way, couple days after this, in Germany, Jews were barred from boxing. So there seems to have been some connection between this fight and the general anti-Semitism that was going on in Europe. And Schmeling was also sort of like promoted the propaganda of Hitler, talked about how there wasn't really, you know, that much, discrimination against the Jews in Europe. So he was sort of like a propaganda win in America to do Hitler's bidding. And Max Baer knocked him out, or at least was declared the winner. And you can actually watch the fight. It's kind of crazy. It doesn't really look like fighting nowadays. Which you always sort of you look at it as sort of more aggressive, but you can see it wasn't a nothing fight. I think it was a heavyweight fight. It wasn't like lightweights or anything like that, like Ruby Goldstein. But this was a big deal. And after this fight, even though Max Baer again wasn't technically Jewish, he wore Jewish star on his shorts for the rest of his career. At least that's what they say. I think Max Baer is profiled in that movie called Cinderella Story. And people know the story. People know that he actually loses in that movie, and he's not presented in the greatest of lights. But either way, that's the story of Max Baer and Jewish pride in boxing. Obviously, as I said before, it tapers off in terms of the prominence of Jews in the sport afterwards, especially once the war starts and things like that. But here you find an interesting notion of Jewish pride in early American culture from the boxing arena. Now let's move into what everybody wants to talk about. Jews in baseball. Hank Greenberg. Now, when we think of Jews in sports, I remember last week when I announced it at one point, I announced it a few times, but one time when I announced it, so I said I was talking about American Jews in sports, so somebody said, oh, so it's going to be a five-minute class. So I said, yes and no, because Jewish athletes aren't particularly known for their prowess. They're not particularly known were putting up the big numbers. They happen to sort of, they crawl in, they barely get in there. They're drafted in like the 50th round. They barely, you know, they get on the bench. Hank Greenberg was the first real American Jewish superstar. He was not just, he didn't just make the team. There were other Jews in the sport, but no one brought Judaism to prominence like Hank Greenberg did when he played for the none other than our very own Detroit Tigers. And Hammer and Hank, you can see already, I don't know if people know how to read baseball statistics, but I'll just guide you through it here. Can people see? You can't see my mouse, can you? I don't think you can. But if you look in, you know, the first line, he's 22 years old. By the way, the history of how these people get into playing these sports is very interesting. You can read up into it later. Apparently, he was recruited. He was looking into or being recruited by the Yankees, but it happens to be that they had somebody named Lou Gehrig playing, so like he couldn't get the job. Either way, Hank Greenberg ends up on the Tigers, and even at age 22, you see he's 22 years old. If you go over, so he plays 117 games, which is a lot for a 22-year-old. Nowadays, even 22-year-olds don't play very often. They're usually in the minor leagues for a while, college, minor leagues. And you can see he already batted 301. If you look at the column named titled BA, that's batting average. That's sort of like your main, you know, what you look at to see if a person is a good hitter. That basically means that if every out of every 10 at-bats, he got 3 hits. It's a great profession. You fail 70% of the time and you're a superstar. But here you see 301 as a 22-year-old was very impressive. And you can see it just goes up and up as he goes down, as he gets older and more experienced. He got 200 hits in a bunch of different seasons. And you can see in year 1938, if you look at the HR column, which stands for home runs, he hit 58 home runs. 58 home runs was unheard of. Only Babe Ruth had more at the time. I think Babe Ruth had, 60? I think it was 60. And there was this big controversy. I watched the documentary about American Jews in baseball where Larry King was interviewed. And Larry King said that they thought, and other people thought this, and his son, you know, sort of responded to it. Steve Greenberg responded to it in the documentary. That people thought that the pitchers weren't pitching to him because they didn't want a Jew to break Babe Ruth's record. It's probably not true. If anyone remembers the days of Barry Bonds, for the positives and the negatives, you don't pitch to somebody because you don't want them to hit home run, not because of who they are. So Hank Greenberg also, they didn't pitch to him because he was hitting home runs, not because he was Jewish. That doesn't make any sense. But he was actually slandered, and people did give him a lot of flack, and he was sort of taunted from the stand. Last week we talked about institutional discrimination, but here he was taunted from the stands a little bit more than simply just being Jewish and being different. So some people created these rumors and things like that. He mostly was able to sort of passively ignore it. Sometimes he had outbursts and sort of screamed back. There's a story about how apparently there was some name-calling coming from a Yankees dugout, and he went over to the dugout and offered to fight every single one of them, individually or collectively. Obviously, it didn't mount to anything because you never heard of it, but apparently he did have to deal with discrimination, so much so that in this documentary it actually has a profile. I don't know how much this is true or how much it isn't, but apparently in 1947, which was his last year, he actually played 1 year for the Pirates and in Pittsburgh. And 1 year he actually, in one game, he actually played against Jackie Robinson of the Dodgers. And there's apparently a meeting at first base. Jackie Robinson was declared safe at first base. There was whatever controversial play. They bumped into each other. Either way, apparently, Hank Greenberg says to Jackie Robinson, "Don't listen to what they're saying. You're a good ball player. You're going to make it." And that was sort of like his, you know, passing the torch from one discriminated player, or discriminated against player, to another, to basically say, "Hang in there, you'll do okay." And Jackie Robinson spoke fondly of Greenberg in response. The point is that Hank Greenberg wasn't just a nobody sitting on the bench. Hank Greenberg was one of the best baseball players in the league. He had won the MVP. He had won a bunch of batting titles. And therefore, that makes it all the more prominent when he's faced with the decision of whether to play on the Yamim Noraim. Now, Hank Greenberg was himself brought up as an Orthodox Jew. He had a bar mitzvah. His parents were Orthodox. Forgot where they came from. I don't want to say like Moravia or something. But either way, he was brought up Orthodox. He wasn't very Orthodox by the time he was a baseball player. But he brought up Orthodox. And much of what prompted him to even think about not playing on the Yom Ha'Nora'im were his parents. So here you have an interesting article, which was printed in the Detroit Jewish Chronicle on September 14th, 1934. This is in some ways in response to how the other national media had covered the story, right? If imagine if the best player in baseball, one of the best players in baseball, was deciding whether or not he should play on a Jewish holiday. So the national media is going to cover it, but they're going to cover it in their own way. So this is in some ways a response to that. You can see it here in the Detroit Jewish Chronicle. Hank's Rosh Hashanah, the epic story of the lanky tiger first baseman who is a hero of the Detroit baseball fans and is acclaimed by boys in the synagogue. It's apparently written by a person named Yalev Yevo. I don't know why they named themselves that, some kind of pseudonym, but that's what it says. I don't know. I don't know if like the author came out later. I don't know. I saw that. I'm like, I'm just not going to. It's not worth investigating. It's probably some kind of funny pseudonym. Person didn't want to be outed at whatever. I don't know if this was like a thing the papers did back then. Either way. So Yalev Yevo writes like this. There are 75,000 Jews in Detroit, but 74,999 were of no consequence on Rosh Hashanah. Wow. What a statement. Only one, I think it's in jest, in satire, but only one Jewish lad mattered to Detroit on that day, Henry Hank Greenberg, the lanky tiger first baseman. It is no exaggeration to say that many Jews forgot their approach to God. This is why we're talking about this, because baseball ruled as king, and that as far as the non-Jewish community was concerned, Greenberg was the only Jew alive. Surprisingly enough, it is a long story with more angles to it than there are prayers. Not really sure what that means. The Detroit Tigers happened to be leading the American League in the race for the pennant. This is important, by the way. This was not the World Series. This was not even the playoffs. This was in order to maintain the Detroit Tigers' lead, which is going to be important for Yom Kippur. And Detroiters have an eye on the World Series. Hank Greenberg happens to be one of the Tiger mainstays. The Detroit Free Press, therefore, started the Rosh Hashanah Greenberg fuss. On Sunday, the Detroit Free Press, not Jewish, right, on Sunday, its sports section appeared with streamers in Hebrew and English wishing Greenberg a happy new year. The new year, the Lashana Tova salutation, it says it in Hebrew, by the way, on the new newspaper. I probably should have put that in there. But either way, the holiday seemed to exist for only one tall 22-year-old great ball player. This is when he's 22 years old. Right, he's not even sort of at his MVP stride yet. He's already making national news. Refuses to go. I think that says Hagba, as we'll see why. The next morning, Hank appeared at Shaarei Tzedek for services. Our very own Shaarei Tzedek. It was not his first time, right? And he goes on talking about how he used to go to shul for different things. A couple paragraphs later says, well, this time all eyes were on Hank, meaning when he went in the past, no one cared. But now he was going. He was handed a talis, a machzer, and was even offered an honor. He was selected to, it says, to go Hagba. Maybe the author Yalev Yevo doesn't really know much about Judaism, but at least maybe they called it there last time. Maybe back then they used to call it to go Hagba. I don't know. To do Hagba. To uplift the Torah following the reading of the law, but modest, at times shy, Henry Greenberg refused. I am only a ball player. He told Venerable Hirsch Alper, the Shamus, give it to someone else who really deserves it. And when Hank walked out of the synagogue at 12:30 on Monday, there was a rush after him. Every boy in the place and many a charming girl followed him to wish him a happy new year. This is Hank Greenberg in 1934 going to Rosh Hashanah davening at Shaarei Tzedek. Now, if you're a national paper and you hear that Hank Greenberg went to shul on the morning of Rosh Hashanah, what are you going to think? Presumably he's not playing the next day or playing that day. So what happens? While Hank was at services on Monday, the newspaper hailed the news in front page, six column streamers, that he was not to play that day on account of Rosh Hashanah. Hank went back to his apartment and immediately a flood of telephone calls came to him from manager Mickey Cochran, from Frank and Charles Navin, the owners of the ball team, from teammates and leading citizens. This is a civic duty, they told him. If Detroit is to win the pennant, you must play. So he goes to shul and an outcry, you know, not over the rabbi's drasha, not because of the chazan's nisana tokef, because Hank Greenberg showed up to davening. So Hank played. In the end of the day, Hank Greenberg played that night on Rosh Hashanah. Not only did he play that night, the Tigers won 2-1. And both of them were because Hank Greenberg hit a home run. He had two solo home runs in the game on the day of Rosh Hashanah. Both were the results of home runs. It was a great day for the Tigers. It was a great day for Henry Greenberg. By the way, his name wasn't really Henry. His parents named him Chaim or Hyman. But apparently, I read one article. I'm not sure how much of this is true. You know, I did my best to sort of parse out what was true, what was false. I can't tell you that what I'm saying is all true either. But apparently they said that the Detroit hospital at the time, or whatever, wherever he was, the hospital at the time didn't think that was a name, so or they thought they meant Henry, so they put down Henry on the birth certificate. So his name became Henry, but his parents named him Chaim. Either way, it was a great day for Detroiters who got a thrill out of this one-man game by a Jewish boy who had already hammered in the winning runs in two preceding games. And it was a great day for the boys on Chicago Boulevard, Rochester Avenue, Boston Boulevard, and the entire neighborhood bordering on the Shaare Tzedek Synagogue. Are those streets in Detroit, or is he saying that other places around the country were...
I think it's Detroit.
Those are in Detroit, too?
Those are in Detroit. Detroit, that's where it's still there. Okay. Still there.
Okay, interesting that they're naming after other cities, but okay. But yeah, okay, interesting. So he's saying around the whole Detroit area, people were very, very, you know, swelled with pride for Hank Greenberg. And the next day, the Detroit News carried a statement which is it accredited to Orthodox Rabbi Joseph Tumim. I don't know if people know the name, familiar with it. He was the rabbi of Beth Abraham. I'm not familiar. I can't tell you all the history. I will tell you that this book that Irwin Cohen gave me, that he wrote from the history of Detroit when I first moved here, I don't know, I think he's in Florida now, but was very helpful in understanding a little bit of the background. And the next day, the Detroit News carried a statement. What?
That's Abraham is Beth Am, the one on Maple.
Okay.
Beth Am, you know, on Maple and Inkster.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't been there, but I've heard of it. The statement which was credited to the Orthodox Rabbi Joseph Tumim at the time he was Orthodox. At the time the shul was Orthodox. Rabbi Tumim was quoted to have gone to the Talmud, quoted, look how they, so even the Detroit Free Press, quoted Bitzo 8:12. Now, this makes no sense. When I read this, I said that does not exist, right? The Babylonian Talmud is not broken up to chapter and verse. The Babylonian Talmud is broken up into pages. So this didn't make any sense when I looked at it, and I had to sort of dig to find the real. And we'll see in a second what he really means. Under the heading of Tosafoth. So at first I thought maybe it was a Tosefta, but Beitza doesn't have eight chapters. The tractate Beitza only has five chapters. So it doesn't make any sense. So I had to look into it. Where the Detroit News reported, it is said that ball was played on the streets of the Sabbath 900 years ago. When I read that, I'm like, what in the world is it talking about? 900 years ago. We're talking now 1934. So 900 years ago must have been 1034. Who are we talking about? Who's playing, you know, ball in the streets on Sabbath 900 years ago, right? Everyone was Orthodox back then. It was Shabbos. So where in the world did that come from? If you go to that documentary I told you about before, so Hank Greenberg is actually interviewed later in life about this, and he says that the rabbis found a source that the children used to play ball in the streets of Jerusalem. And I'm like, what in the world is... There's got to be a lot of misinformation going on because that didn't exist. There's a prophecy about children playing ball in Yerushalayim again, you know, or playing later on in history, but that hadn't happened yet. I guess Yeshvu, maybe it means that it once was and it could be again, but there are a lot of misinformation, and clearly Hank Greenberg didn't even know what he was talking about when he read this. So what exactly is going on here? He was reported as having quoted the Shulchan Aruch and to have told the newspaper to tell Greenberg that he may play on the Sabbath and the holy days. Now Greenberg has the Hechsher, right? That's how the paper writes it. Now Greenberg has the Hechsher, and it will be recorded that he played and won a game on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. This article makes it sound like Chaim Greenberg asked the Shaila of Rabbi Tumim. It in no way happened like that, right? Hank went to shul in the morning. He wasn't necessarily thinking of not playing, but he went to shul, it got to the papers, and then he got a flood of phone calls, and he was going to play anyway, or at least he was thinking of playing, and they convinced him to play. He never asked the rabbi. Apparently what happened, and Irwin Cohen quotes here from a different article that Rabbi Tooman wrote in clarifying what happened, that after Greenberg played and played well, so they came to Tumim, Rabbi Tumim, and they said, "Rabbi, this doesn't look so good. You know, the star baseball player plays on Rosh Hashanah. Isn't that a problem?" So in response to that, interrogation, Tumim goes to the books and discusses whether it was justified for Greenberg to have played. Greenberg never asked him. Greenberg never based anything on his reporting. It happened after the fact. What exactly did Tumim say? So let's crack the code a little bit. So he quotes a couple different things. First, he quotes Beitza 8:12. I don't know if maybe this was a verbal conversation and really they meant page 12, but there is a Tosfos at the bottom of the daf on Beitza daf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, where he's talking about Ochel Nefesh and how far it reaches in terms of one's allowance to play on Yontif, specifically on Yontif, for the sake of Ochel Nefesh. Are you allowed to do certain things for Ochel Nefesh? That's the Mishnah talks about. You're allowed to carry Sefer Torah, you're allowed to do Bris Milah, you're allowed to do different things for the sake, and we talked about that Gemara, for those in Daf Yom, we talked about it in the Kuf Lamids, I think, in Shabbos. But either way, so... says Tosfos at the bottom of the daf, Leisa Perushan Delav Dafka Katan Lemulo. It's not just a child who you can give a bris milah to on Shabbos, on Yontif. Dehu Adin Shalol Lemulo. Even if it wasn't for the sake of a bris, Deshari Gam Teal. Even just to have some, luxury time. You know, it's a little sprawl. Deha Ashkechan. How do we know? Deha Ashkechan. Because we find, right? This is Tosfos talking, presumably about his community. Ashkechan nami demesachkin bekador shekorin plota. I didn't look into the origins of what this word is, but he says that the children are playing, or people are playing. Doesn't say even children, but presumably based on the heels of the children getting bris milah, maybe that means also the children are playing. That they're playing with a ball on Yontif, b'yom tov birshus harabim, even in the public domain, deleika ela teol. That's only sort of luxury. There's nothing particularly mitzvahic about it, and therefore says Tosfos, it must be, or he has obviously more halakhic sources to say this, it must be that other things that are for the sake of Yontif are allowed. I actually want to quote the end of it, because I didn't quote the whole thing at the bottom. At the very bottom, he says. And he quotes a different thing. Ma tzorech yesh lo ba. What kind of tzorech ochel nefesh, right? What kind of necessity is there? Yesh lomer dehacha nami ika simchas yantif. There's something called simchas yantif, and you're allowed to play ball for the sake of that on yantif. As long, of course, as you're not violating an actual malacha, right? So that's what basically Tosfos is pointing at here. Presumably, almost certainly, this is what Rabbi Tooman was talking about. Meaning that when Tosfos says it, Tosfos comes in the 13th century, 12th century, maybe even the children and grandchildren of Rashi. So he's quoting this as saying that 900 years ago, people played ball on Yontif, not on Shabbos. And he's basically on Tosfos is talking about his community, that they were doing it. Now, what does that mean? Last week, we talked about how that's not really allowed. Right, we talked about how it's against the spirit of Shabbos, it's the spirit of Yontif, and maybe that's not something a person should be doing. However, if you look again, there's an added element to it. Oops, sorry. A little sneak peek there. But there's an added element to it that's not just about actually playing the ball, which we talked about last week in terms of Rishas HaRabim, Rishas HaYachid, in terms of an Erev, in terms of making treads in the ground, right? All those things could be avoided if you do them in a particular way, at least in a technical sense, even though they're against the spirit of Shabbos. We saw the Aruch HaShulchan and said, basically, let them have Simchas Yontif on their Dat HaShafel, right? That he said their low-level understanding of what Shabbos is all about. Now, the Shulchan Aruch also says in Aruch Chaim Shin Lamed Ches, that you're allowed to play with things on Yantif, but only if it's frivolous. That's only if you're doing it in general joyfulness. In order to make money, usser, that you can't do. Even if you're going to do it in a different way, I think he's talking about, or simply you're not doing it, that's like mekach memkar mikol makom. However, if you find women or children doing it, so let them do it. We talked about this in our tochacha class a few months ago, better for them to be doing it by accident than to be doing it on purpose, so don't say anything to them, right? Don't make a fuss about it. In terms of playing specifically with a ball, we'll talk about that, you know, go back to Shin Ches to understand. We talked about that last week. And then, so Rabbi Tumen quotes that also in his response in terms of his clarification in the Detroit Free Press, Detroit Jewish Chronicle, sorry. And he quotes this and saying that would also seem to be that a person's profession, you're not allowed to do it if it includes playing on Yantif. However, then he quotes Shin Vav. Hasochar sapolim shmor zraim o davar achar eno nosim lo schar shabbos lefikach en achray shabbos alav. If a person hires workers to do a job and he's getting paid by the day, so then he has no obligation to pay, or he's not allowed to. You're not allowed to make money on Shabbos itself for the work that you make on you do on Shabbos. Hayasachar Shabbos, Hayasachar Chodesh, Sachar Shana, Sachar Shavua, so nosin lo schar Shabbos. Right, if a person is a weekly worker, monthly worker, or a yearly worker, meaning they're salaried in some way, that it's not a day-to-day type of compensation, so then you do actually have to pay them, because you're not specifically paying them for what they did on Shabbos. So says Rabbi Tumen, it's justified in the terms of the sense that maybe you could say playing with ball, as we said last week, is not strictly prohibited, and maybe it's okay even if he's being paid for it, because he's being paid as a salaried worker and not paid based on the game that he's playing. So Rabbi Tumen basically said, you can justify it, right? Rabbi Tumen, Orthodox rabbi, is trying to look for the actual sources and figure out what exactly he should be doing. And he says it's justifiable, but it's not exactly clear that he meant. I'll just read you the last paragraph of this, according to Erwin Cohen's quoting. It must be understood that the foregoing about ball playing on Saturdays applies only in the European cities where there is an Erev, streets enclosed in accordance with Jewish law or in places surrounded by a wall. On the open street, it is not even permitted to carry a ball. So he's saying that there are clarifications to this. It's not just like he's saying you can do whatever you want in terms of playing ball, but that there are some things, there are restrictions to this. So he sort of bends over backwards. He uses his thumbs a little bit to figure out in a way you can justify Hank Reber playing on Yantif. And this has happened in other ways also, but it really obviously goes against the spirit of the day. He was just trying to justify it post facto about how it could be not sort of the end of the world that Hank Greenberg was going against the holiday. But it in no way happened in the way that people understood it, that Hank Greenberg didn't ask a shaila and he was given permission. It was just sort of he played. Again, he wasn't very religious and he played against his parents' wishes probably, but nonetheless, the rabbi was post facto justifying his activity. Aaron.
I think he also didn't play on Yom Kippur.
Okay, so that's next. Then comes Yom Kippur. By the time Yom Kippur came along, by the way, they were already guaranteed the winning the pennant, meaning that it wasn't that big of a deal if he missed the game. So on that day, he actually skipped the game and he didn't play. And there's a famous poem that was written. I know last week Sandy sent me a poem. Or Jerry sent me a poem about, I think it was Larry Mendoza last week. So here's another poem about Yom Kippur and Hank Greenberg not playing that year. Came Yom Kippur, this is the end of the poem. Came Yom Kippur, holy feast day, I probably should be holy fast day, worldwide over to the Jew, and Hank Greenberg to his teaching and the old tradition true. Spent the day among his people and he didn't come to play. Said Murphy to Mulroney, we shall lose the game today. We shall miss him on the field and shall miss him at the bat, but he's true to his religion, and I honor him for that. So there's a certain respect that even though he missed the game and they did lose, right? There was a certain respect for a person standing up for his values. Hank Greenberg did not play. However, one could make the case that that was only because he wasn't needed to play. Later on, you can see here another time, the next year, a couple years later, this was a Yom Kippur that he actually did want to play. This is an article I found on NBCSports.com where the author says, quotes his mother. He says, "I don't want him to play," his mother predicted to reporters, "but he'll play anyway." She was right. Hank made his choice. The evening before Game 6, the Tigers were going to win, by the way, but they didn't need Hank Greenberg, but it was the World Series. The evening before Game 6, Greenberg told manager Mickey Cochran that he would play. Hank says he can play, and that's what he'll do if he's really right, all right, if he's really all right again. Cochran told reporters, I think he was hurt, maybe. Greenberg showed up early that day, got a rub down, taped his fractured wrist, and put on a glove. He asked the teammate to throw him the ball. When the ball hit his glove, the pain was so overwhelming that the normally invincible Greenberg grunted in pain. He took off the glove and immediately admitted defeat. He could not play. The Tigers won the World Series that day. I was in uniform, Greenberg would say, but I felt like a stranger on the ball team that I helped lead to the pennant. Unclear what he means by that, but maybe it was because of Yom Kippur. Later on, Greenberg would say, "I realize now more than I used to how important a part I played in the lives of a generation of Jewish kids who grew up in the 30s. I guess I was kind of a role model. It's a strange thing. When I was playing, I used to resent being singled out as a Jewish player, period. I'm not sure why or when I changed because I'm still not a particularly religious person. Lately, though, I find myself wanting to be remembered not only as a great ball player, but even as a great Jewish ball player." Regardless of what Greenberg actually did and how he went about his decisions, it doesn't seem like he did them in such sort of the greatest sort of religious fervency as much as he did it as of Jewish guilt for his parents. You see here that he was willing to play on Yom Kippur itself in the next couple of years, but nonetheless, it was never the case. Hank Greenberg never actually played a baseball game on Yom Kippur. Sometimes it didn't work out, sometimes it wasn't relevant, but he's known for that stance. He's known for that episode, sort of like putting, you know, Judaism on the same pedestal as ball playing was itself a statement. And he's well known for that. And later in history, 30 years later, when Sandy Koufax is tasked with whether to play or not, he remembers the story of Hank Greenberg, and it actually did influence him in what decision to make. Sandy Koufax was another unbelievable superstar, probably the best known Jewish sports player just because he played in a later era on a more prominent national team, the Dodgers. And he also made bigger news in the fact that he was the best pitcher on the team and he decided not to play in the World Series. Right, so that's bigger than Hank Greenberg, who might have not played on Rosh Hashanah and then did play in Rosh Hashanah, and didn't play in Yom Kippur in a meaningless game later on. But if you look at the statistics here, you'll notice something very interesting. I don't know if people know this about Sandy Koufax, but the first 6 years of his career, he wasn't that unbelievable. He was a good pitcher. As you can see, ERA for the pitcher, for pitchers, the statistic you want to look at is the ERA. So here the ERA, anything below 4 is pretty good. You can see here, he didn't play very much. He only played a few games when he was 19 years old. By the way, Sandy Koufax was not going to be a pitcher. He was supposed to be a basketball player. He actually played basketball with the owner of the Mets. What's the guy's name? I think they own the Knicks also. Anyone know the guy's name? I forgot his name now. Either way, he played with that guy, and ultimately, he wanted to sort of go on a trip with his college and ended up going onto the baseball team so he could play, and he ends up like actually being pretty good. So he ends up pitching for the Dodgers, and there's this whole thing about how he actually turned his whole pitching technique around. As you can see, already in 1960, his ERA goes down, but then in 1961... he has an ERA of 3.52, which is pretty good. Win-loss of 18-13. That, to modern baseball fans, sounds crazy. How does a guy pitch for 31 games? Nowadays, if a pitcher pitches enough of a game to get 30 games, and they must have pitched like 50 games in the year. That's almost impossible. Sandy Koufax, baseball back then in general, but Sandy Koufax specifically, didn't have the same kind of resting strategy that most pitchers have today. And it took a toll, as you see. He only played 12 seasons. He retired when he was 31 years old. That's because of the toll that it took on his arm. But either way, if you see in 1962, his ERA was 2.54. And you see in 1963, 1.88. That's unheard of for a starting pitcher to have such an ERA. 1.74, 2.04, 1.73. The stuff in bold means that he led the league. He was the best pitcher in the entire league. When is it that he actually, and you can see 26-8, 27-9. He had like 5 no-hitters. He had 1 perfect game. It was unbelievable. Like things that players can't do anymore. 27 wins is unheard of. I don't remember the last time someone had more than 25 wins. Not that I'm a big baseball aficionado, but it's very, very rare for a person to get that many wins anymore. And with a 1.73 ERA, that is crazy. It's really crazy. If you look at the strikeouts also, I think he was league leader in strikeouts. Where are the strikeouts? At the end here, 317 strikeouts, 382 strikeouts. Really unbelievable statistics. When was the Yom Kippur game? It was when he was 29 years old. He was having one of the best seasons of a pitcher ever, 1965. And it's the game one of the World Series. They're playing, I believe, was it the Yankees they were playing? I think they were playing the Yankees. Either way, World Series Game 1, 1965. Sandy Koufax's refusal to pitch on Yom Kippur still resonates. This is the 50-year anniversary article on ESPN.com. There was no hard decision for me, Koufax told ESPN in 2000. It was just a thing of respect. I wasn't trying to make a statement. I had no idea that it would impact that many people. Nor was it an issue with his Dodgers teammates. Nobody said a word. Nobody thought a bad thing about him, says Wes Parker, the first baseman in the 1965 LA team. We respected him because he was doing it because of his religion. He was being true to himself. This was much less controversial. It was a bigger deal because it was the World Series and it was the best pitcher in the league. But it wasn't like it caused this whole hullabaloo with his teammates and he didn't face discrimination like Hank Greenberg did. Yeah, David.
A starting first baseman like Greenberg plays every day.
Yeah.
A pitcher in those Good. Days, pitchers played usually every 4 games.
Right.
Or 3.
Yeah.
3 to 4. 4 was a normal rotation. So maybe he wasn't scheduled for that day anyway.
Okay, so this is the interesting thing. In previous years, you notice how in the previous years, he had pitched for a long time, right? This is not his first rodeo. So what did he do on Yom Kippur the other years? For Hank Greenberg, it was his first, second year in the league. So that made that decision that much more influential. But what exactly did he do on the other year, Sandy Koufax? So Sandy Koufax says that he never played on those days because he always used to pitch the day before instead. Whenever a game fell out on Yom Kippur, he would pitch the day before and he'd take the day off. As David's saying, if you're a pitcher, you don't play every day. The difference was strategy in the World Series is you pitch your best pitcher as early as possible so that you can pitch them later on. So when Koufax was deciding whether to play on Yom Kippur, he was deciding because it was the first game of the World Series. And if you're the best pitcher on a team, you want to pitch the first day, and then you take a couple days off and you pitch the fourth game. And then if you're needed, so you'll pitch the seventh game also, right? If the series goes that long, which is why it's important for the first game you pitch your best pitcher. So Koufax was the best pitcher. That's why it was a bigger deal, because it was the World Series he had to pitch. We'll see exactly what happens. Ultimately, a different player pitches, right? Plus, it wasn't like the Dodgers were reduced to starting, say, Matt Lotus, latest, I don't know, in Koufax's place. As Thorne says, there wasn't much of a drop-off with Drysdale, a future Hall of Famer who was 23-12 with a 2.77 ERA. They had another great pitcher, Dan Drysdale, who was unbelievable in his own right. They didn't need Sandy to play the first game, so it wasn't as big of a deal. Unfortunately for the Dodgers, Drysdale did not fare well against the Minnesota in Game 1. The Twins scored 7 runs off him in less than 3 innings in their eventual 8-2 victory as both Versailles, I guess, and Don Mincher homered. Minnesota roughed up the big right-hander so badly that when manager Walter Aston came out to the mound to relieve him. Drysdale equipped, "I bet right now you wish I was Jewish too," which is just a great line, because obviously he doesn't want him to pitch because how badly he pitched. What happens after this? Really a sort of a testament to Koufax. Koufax comes in and he pitches game two, right? So game one, they lost. They're down 0-1. He comes in and he pitches game two, and he actually loses. He gives up two runs, which is not a ton of runs, especially in the World Series. You're playing the best team in the league. He gives up two runs, but they end up losing 5-1. So Koufax pitches game two. And then the question is, well, who's going to pitch game three, game four? Ultimately, Koufax pitches game five. He pitches again on short day's rest. He pitches game five. He wins game five. He gives up only four hits, I think, or five hits. And he gives up no runs. He pitches the entire game, all nine innings. And I think it was 3 days later that Koufax pitches game seven. Right? So Koufax, even though he missed game one, he pitches three out of the seven games. What do you mean? He pitched three out of the remaining six games. Unbelievable performance with Koufax. In the seventh game, he wins the World Series. He also shuts them out again with 10 strikeouts, only giving up a couple hits, and ultimately sort of redeems himself for not playing on the first day, but ultimately plays on the second, fifth, and seventh. I believe it was the fifth. Might have been the fourth. But unbelievable pitcher. Only a couple years later, he unfortunately had to retire because of the damage to his arm. But that's the legacy of Sandy Koufax is much greater than Hank Greenberg just because of in terms of folklore, because of how much more available the games were, how much more sort of public they were, and in the mainstream they were. By 1965, it was sort of like America's real sport. By in the 30s, it was a popular sport, but it wasn't like all the rage. And Greenberg sort of, you know, was dealing with some anti-Semitism. By the way, Greenberg was an unbelievable person also. He went in and he was drafted into the war, and then he came back to the war, and then he enlisted again, even though he didn't have to. And he goes and he fights for the American forces, obviously. Comes back and has a couple more years after that, but really unbelievable person. He put his whole career to the side so that he can fight for the Jews. But either way, this is some of the most... These were some of the most influential sporting events that brought out sort of Jewish pride. The boxers of the early 20th century, Hank Greenberg in the 30s facing much discrimination, and then Koufax in the 60s, even though it was better. Who's Steve A. Cohen, Evan? No, not Steve Cohen. That's the new one. I'm talking about the old one. The one that was there for a lot of years. I forgot his name now. You're talking about the owner of the Mets. No, it's not him. Who's the owner of the Mets? Anyone know?
Steve Cohen?
No, who was the previous owner? The owner of the...
The Wilpon family.
Yes, the Wilpons. Sandy Koufax went to college with one of the Wilpons and was on the basketball team with them. And they ultimately, I think they played baseball together after that. So it was like a whole thing that the two of them sort of became prominent in the sporting industry. But obviously most Jews are more prominent in terms of managerial positions and other positions. But interesting to know where the Jewish pride comes in these different circumstances. Not really from religious players, as we talked about before, but at least from these certain times, as we said earlier, there's a certain pride that came out, especially at those times where Jews were being more assimilated, especially in the 30s, trying to sort of get a hold of what they can do in life, and in the 60s, where there was a lot of assimilation going on, and these instances, although coming from non-religious players, actually did bring about a certain Jewish pride in a lot of people that they didn't have before. So that's a wrap on the early American Jewish sports events or figures that we can learn from. Obviously not as halachic as we usually do, but in honor of Larry, memory of Larry, Mirat Hashem, the learning should be Le'il Nishmaso, especially the halachic parts that we talked about in the middle. But nonetheless, there you have it. Jews in sports, continues today. There are a lot of Jews in sports now. It's getting harder to be a full Jew in sports, but to find full Jews in sports, but nonetheless, they exist. Not a lot of prominent, there are some prominent sort of Jewish pride moments every now and then. You know, in the Olympics, sometimes things happen like that, especially with Israel, where you stand up for the Jewish people, but nothing like Hank Greenberg and Sandy Koufax. Okay, everyone should be well. Enjoy the rest of your holiday day. If you're off, you have that opportunity. And everyone should have a good Shabbos.